Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers. F up the black police. That 13th Amendment. Trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free. Okay, free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, in the bill here, up coin tail pro. Show, they got me started, lying hearted, I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we wise up, unity so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black owned, black power moves. You telling lies, you think this shit gon' be televised. Black power, be scared guys, they be standing there like they paralyzed, huh? We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth the crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fuck me promise.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free. Okay, free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, in the bill here, up coin sale pro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit, I don't tolerate it. Melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack upped up another conversation. Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police department to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prison. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
Black Power, welcome to the New Black Panther Party Radio. Mic check, mic check. We are getting ready to start tonight's clip. We want to thank everybody for being the constant supporter of the New Black Panther Party Radio. On a nightly basis, we have been bringing you back-to-back information on reparations because, yes, it is time that we turn the tables over in the temple. We have fought. We have protested. We have ran for office. We've held every seat of office that it is to offer in this country, and yet there is no justice. And we have made a concentrated effort to make sure that for the last almost year, we are keeping this airways bombarded with everything and anything that has to do with reparations, brothers and sisters. This is our unified fight. Let's not get no misunderstanding of what it is that we are trying to accomplish here. If you are a nightly listener to this program, we want you to support the New Black Panther Party by going to our website at www.nbpp.org. That's nbpp.org, and make a donation to support the work of this broadcast. This broadcast is not done without a cost. We spend money on a regular basis to make sure that we're able to bring you this information. It requires a monthly subscription. It requires us to upload content. It requires us to be consistent to make sure that every night we're bringing you the truth. So with that being said, be sure you support the New Black Panther Party by going to nbpp.org. Click that donate button. It's going to take you to our Black Cross website. Once you get to the Black Cross website, we want you to click that donate button. We want you to look at both sites so that you can understand our ideology. You can see the work that we've been doing in these streets, from the Black Panther Party to the Black Cross as our humanitarian arm of the New Black Panther Party. And click that donate button. And if you have the heart and the mighty mentality of a revolutionary freedom fighter, we want you to click the join button on the nbpp.org site. So we want you to visit both sites. There should be no reason that you are listening to this broadcast and you do not support this organization. We're going to continue our second symposium on reparations under international law, Black Power.
Greetings, everyone. It gives me great pleasure to convene the first discussant panel for this, the second symposium on reparations under international law for enslavement of African persons in the Americas and the Caribbean, following the first symposium that was held in 2021. Welcome. We've already had a very rich series of discussions today. We heard powerful opening remarks from Greg Schaefer, President of the American Society of International Law, Judge Robinson, I'm getting a message from you that you're having trouble hearing me. Let me do a tech check. Can you hear me? Okay, I'm getting word that I can be heard, so I will continue. Welcome, everyone. This is the first discussant panel for this, the second symposium on reparations under international law for enslavement of African persons in the Americas and the Caribbean. We've had a very rich series of discussions today. We heard powerful opening remarks from Greg Schaefer, President of the American Society of International Law, and from Vereen Shepherd, Director of the Center for Reparation Research at the University of the West Indies. We then heard insightful and illuminating presentations from Judge Patrick Robinson of the International Court of Justice and from Sir Hilary Beckles, Vice Chancellor of the West Indies. Judge Robinson and Sir Hilary Beckles provided an overview of legal and economic aspects of the case for reparations. Finally, we were able to hear the report from Coleman Bazelon and Alberto Vargas of the Brattle Group Consultancy, presenting findings from a larger team of researchers who devoted their considerable expertise to providing and substantiating estimates for damages both during and after the period of formal transatlantic chattel slavery. That report, with the rest of today's earlier discussions, sets the stage for the current panel, in which we'll have the opportunity to hear from three distinguished speakers, Professors Mamadou Abye, Adrian Wing, and Don Marshall. We will hear from the speakers in that order. I'll briefly introduce them now, and then I'll turn the floor to Dr. Abye. Thank you again for joining this discussion. So first we'll hear from Dr. Mamadou Abye, who's Associate Professor of International Law at the Grotius Center for International Legal Studies at Leiden University. He holds a PhD from the Graduate Institute of International and Development Studies and is also a graduate of Harvard Law School, the Geneva Academy of International Humanitarian Law and Human Rights, and the Hague Academy of international law. His thesis on agreements concluded between colonial powers and local political entities as a means of acquiring territorial sovereignty was awarded the Paul Guggenheim Prize in International Law in 2016. He's also served as lecturer at the Graduate Institute of International Development Studies and a special assistant to the President of the International Court of Justice. Next, we'll hear from Professor Adrian Wing, who is the Associate Dean for International and Comparative Law Programs and the Bessie Dutton Murray Professor at the University of Iowa College of Law. She serves in a number of other leadership roles as well at the University of Iowa, including as the Director of the Center for Human Rights. She's an author of more than 140 publications and is the editor of the groundbreaking volumes Critical Race Feminism, A Reader, and Global Critical Race Feminism, An International Reader. Her U.S.-oriented scholarship has focused on race and gender discrimination, and her international scholarship has emphasized Africa and the Middle East, international law and feminism, international law and race, and the Arab world and women's rights, among other topics. Last but certainly not least, we'll hear from Professor Don Marshall, who is University Director of the renowned Sir Arthur Lewis Institute of Social and Economic Studies at the University of the West Indies. He sits on the boards of a number of key scholarly journals and has authored the volume Caribbean Political Economy at the Crossroads, NAFTA and Regional Developmentalism, published by Palgrave Macmillan, and he's the editor and co-author of a number of other volumes and articles. His research has centered on addressing the Caribbean international political economy complex over time with the express aim of highlighting where development transformation is possible via the structural opportunities on offer at specific conjunctures. And he's also focused on industrial policy issues and democracy and governance in the Eastern and wider Caribbean. So we truly have an eminent panel of commentators, and it's my great privilege to be able to convene this panel and begin this discussion. Dr. Ebier, I now turn the floor to you.
Thank you very much, Thomas, for this kind introduction and for giving me the floor. I hope you can hear me well, and there is no problem. I would like to thank the organizer for this opportunity and giving me to submit on the virtual report and to engage for a second time with this very interesting question of reparation of the breaches of international law that occurred during state service. It's also the opportunity to commend Judge Robinson for carrying on this project to the end and for bringing all of us together. The discussion table. My third note of thanks goes to the Bracken Group, which has produced a fantastic report. Let me say the report is very clear, easy to read, and I would say even for international lawyers. So this is a math, deals with numbers, but really very accessible. And I was extremely impressed by the way that they have been able to make clear the different parameters that they are taking into account when they are assessing the amount of difficulty for the breaches of the international committee during also the reality of the fact that the assumptions are being restated and this really facilitates the legal arrangement. But here I am at a discussion and I need to find a number of issues that I could highlight. And my perspective has been to identify some key issues which I believe someone who would not share the agenda to pay reparation may raise when he or she receives the report. So my goal is really to make sure that we are all, we look at the report from also what I could consider areas where it could improve. So that we look at areas where the report could be improved. And although I don't have an answer to all the comments or the issues that I could sense, I think that it will be, it will be useful to raise them at this stage. And I think I will just make four comments, three that are methodological, and one which is substantive and concerns the place of Africa in the report. So concerning the first three methodological comments, I saw that at different juncture in the report decides to go systematically for the lowest number of their estimates. So for instance, if you look at page 97, the number of people born in theory, after taking into account the different parameters, the report decides to take what it considers to be the lowest bound of the number of people that were born into slavery. And when I read that, what I had in mind was
Mamadou, just checking with you. Is everything all right? We were getting a little bit muffled sound, but otherwise you look good.
Okay. Is it better?
This is better. Yes, you are clearer.
Okay. So let me just change. Okay, turn the camera on. Okay. So continue. So I was saying that I would make three methodological comments before making a substantive comment which relates to the place of Africa in the report. And with respect to the first methodological comment, I noted that at different junctures in the report focuses on the lowest number of their estimate. So for instance, when they're assessing the number of people born into slavery, the report decided to look at the lowest number that they could find. I understand that this can be explained by caution, by the fact that we want to remain on the safe side. But the question is whether this is a legal issue, which should therefore be assessed as a matter of law, or whether it is just a matter of assessing the damages or calculation, which could be left to economists. And it seems to me that at least if it was at an international court or tribunal, it would be rather the court who will decide what is the degree of certainty that it has with respect to the different numbers, and probably it will not systematically go for the lower number of the estimate. But Judge Robinson is with us, and I would like to hear his views on this point. So perhaps it might be useful for the report to indicate the lowest bound, what could be the average, and the maximum number, and then leave it to lawyers to find the criteria that they believe as far as accuracy is concerned, to determine what is, as a matter of law, the correct, at least the number which can be judicially approved. My second concern also relates to a statement that I found in the report, and it really relates again in this articulation of tasks between lawyers and economists in assessing damages. And it reads at page 36 that sexual violence against slave women was legal at that time. And in footnote, you have a reference to a judgment of the United States Supreme Court. Having worked a lot with colonial history, I came to be a little bit skeptical about this kind of statement. And I'm not making a firm view as to whether it is correct or not. It's just that I believe that the issue should be investigated a little bit more in order to, before taking it for granted. But if I was to speak, not just as a lawyer, but just as a matter of legal reasoning, I would say one thing. The reason why this kind of statement tend not to be true is the fact that it's not the law, which is, the law prohibits rape. Now, you consider that a slave is not a human being, and therefore you use it as a property, including committing sexual violence against her. If later it is proved that you were wrong in your characterization of a human being as a property, I don't think that this makes your act lawful. So it's from this background that I come from, and that's the reason why I look at it with some reservation. So what I was wondering would be whether in areas such as this one, if it was not better to rely more on legal input and not take things easily for granted. And thirdly, I had a sense when reading the report that the report was relying extensively on U.S. Practice. And to give you an example, I remember that when trying to ascertain the percentage of physical injury, the report used as a base rate the percentage of physical injury that occurred during the 9/11 terrorist attacks. So it's difficult. It's difficult, and I don't have an alternative because there is no way to know exactly whether in the U.S. in different places where slavery was taking place, what was the percentage of physical injury compared to death. But it seems to me that if to the extent possible, and I understand that it can be just practically impossible to do it, but it will be good to try to diversify the sources of base rate. And there are parts in the report where this is done, but there are more areas where U.S. practice is quickly taken into account. Now, there is one substantive comment that I would like to make, and it relates to the fact that the quantum of the damage that is calculated does not take into account the damage that could be owed to African countries themselves. And I agree with Sir Beckles that if we want this reparation project to be successful, it will require the combined efforts of African countries and the Caribbean and all the defendants to push in the same direction. So I was wondering whether it will not be good to take into account also the compensation and try to estimate the compensation that would need to be paid to African countries and people in Africa for slavery. And when it comes to calculating this exact quantum, I was wondering whether our focus on the breaches, on the damage caused by the breaches of international law during slave trade was really the only approach that we could take. Because I felt that we could also perhaps draw from the Marxist concept of original accumulation of capital. And the reason why I'm saying this is that we live in a capitalist society. And in a capitalist society, it's very difficult to be a player when you don't have original capital. If you don't have, in the beginning of the game, the capital that is needed in order to transform your resources into wealth and into more capital in order to play. And I believe that one of the obstacles to African countries and Caribbean and Pacific countries to development is having access to this original capital. But we think at the moment when Europe launched its development, it was able to get this free access to capital, in part by commodifying and chattelizing Africans during colonialism, and then by exploiting their lands and resources, chattelization and commodification during the slavery, and then exploitation of the lands and natural resources during colonialism. So the question then becomes whether instead of thinking of calculating the amount of compensation to be paid based on the breaches of international law in the 19th century, the question does not become how can we make sure that the descendants of people who were formerly enslaved get access to original capital. How do we make sure that they get access to original capital in order to be able to prompt their development? But not only also the capital, because it's not just paying money and disappearing. It's also looking at the current system of international relations and removing all the hidden obstacle, the structural obstacle, if you take into it the monetary and financial rules and all the other rules, economic rules, which are making it more difficult for those countries who have been under slavery and then colonization and then neo-colonialism to really engage freely in international development. It seems to me that this approach would be forward-looking, and the fact that it gives a result to be attained in terms of development is much, much better than just paying money and believing that it absolves all the breaches of international law that were occurring. But really, this is a recent idea that I've been thinking about, so I look forward to hearing your views. And I thank again the Bratel Group and the organizer for this stimulating report and discussion. Thank you very much.
I'm wondering if I should, I've been asked in the chat to go next, but I'm wondering if I should do that without the intervention of the moderator, or should I just go ahead? Because there was an error in the running order as listed and as stated before. So I've been asked to go next.
Yes, do I proceed? Yes, please go ahead, Professor Marshall. My apologies.
Oh, no problem. No problem. Okay, thank you very much. My intervention is intended to do two things. One, I want to acknowledge the very difficult task of the framers of this report in trying to, including those that are not presenting but listed as contributors to the report, in trying to come up with virtually a very difficult task of trying to estimate the cost of damage and the cost of loss and arising from enslavement, arising from genocide, as Sahiri indicated, genocide that was also part of that experience. And certainly from the Caribbean region's vantage point, this story also includes attempts at native genocide of the indigenous people. So we do have that element also to consider when we are looking to estimate the extent to which there has been a near impossible calculus around the kind of harms done to Caribbean people and their descendants, including, of course, as I indicated earlier, descendants of indigenous peoples. And then we want to also include in that group Maroon communities in Jamaica especially. So I want to applaud the effort to come up with a quantification where some of us may be philosophically wrestling with the idea that some things cannot really be reduced to monetary values. I am one that's wrestling with that, but not in a way that suggests that there's closure around efforts and scholarship to bring about a quantification matched with an idea that the reparatory justice process really ought to be understood as one that goes beyond current models of intervention that speaks of aid, donor assistance, and other forms of providing capital, materials, and technical assistance to countries, regions, families that have been affected by this historical wrong. So I should say that philosophically, I want to indicate that from the way I see it, the challenge really we have is the kind of grammar we will employ for claims making, for the claims making that is part and parcel of the reparatory justice struggle, indeed the reparations endeavor, that an appeal that goes beyond that Caribbean people have been engaging. It connects up with what the brother who just spoke about when he speaks of global Africa's appeal for reparations. So my concern, my intervention really is about the grammar we employ, the way in which we speak about cost, damage, loss, etc. And I want to say that there are dangers inherent in trying to reduce this to, and I'm not accusing the framers of the report of doing so, but you know, the more you a quandary in epistemology, a quandary that develops when you try to produce a source of information and knowledge rooted in trying to come up with a positivist calculus of measurable objective damages, while seeking to acknowledge that it really is difficult because a lot of the damage is incalculable. So that one of the moderator of this morning's session would have indicated that, and throughout the challenge, you want to know how we would quantify psychological damage, because that's really difficult to quantify. So the framers of the reports are doing brilliant work, and it's governed by an intention that we must really calculate the cost of the weight of the loss. I prefer to frame it. The weight of the loss, the weight of the damages, the weight of this historical wrong. And if we had to steer or lever the discussion away from just talking about monetary values and to talk about building and bridging a process of reparatory justice, of which an estimation of the harms is a part and parcel of what we talk about when we're talking about reparatory justice, If you talk about trying to come up with an estimate of the harms, then it paves the way morally, ethically, epistemologically to speak about ways in which we undertake repair and renewal. Because once you've established that there were harms, and from the best efforts at quantifying such, we come up with X figure, Y figure, as brilliantly postulated by the framers of the report and those that spoke to that report today, I think it paves the way for us to then say, look, building a bridge in a process of reparatory justice means we come to grips with the costs associated, we come to grips with the need for justice and accountability for the unremedied and unprecedented wrongs against humanity and every relation for sustainable being and becoming in life. Justice cannot be secured, we would argue, if the moral and spiritual debt is elided and redress overlooked. So when I look at the report, I see an estimate of the harms and a scope, an optics for addressing the need for redress. So I would say that repair ought to be seen as an ethical project entailing the healing of relations and the status of the parties. And we want to also add and suggest that even as we come up with a quantum of what these harms have cost the regions and peoples affected, we start off with a philosophical position that the violators cannot redress the weight of the loss, and that the estimation of harms provides only a moral reckoning towards needs produced in the context of injustice. So because of the injustice accumulated, sedimented, carried forward, the harms will produce needs in the context of injustice. And it's the descendants that continue to bear the brunt of the injustice. So reparations then in that sense is about addressing or redressing the needs of the descendants of these people for whom crimes were committed, for whom genocide and attempts at near genocide were committed, and for whom their humanity was denied through enslavement, etc. So we're talking about a reckoning that ought to be addressed with in tangible ways, and it's those that suffered the harm that have to estimate what that cost will entail. And I think it's important that we make the point that it's, you know, we need to listen to those who carry and live the legacies of race and harm, the legacies of racialized wealth and exchange, and that if we're talking renewal, if we're talking, if we're talking socio-ecological and economic renewal of Caribbean countries, for example, in light of the harms that were caused to the people, the biodiversity, the ecological harm, if we start to do an estimate of all the harms caused, say, to the Caribbean as a region within the Americas, then we are beginning to talk about the need for redress and repair. And these figures then become very, very relevant when we have shifted the grammar of claims making away from one that says you owe me X based on a calculus of damage and loss, you owe me X, to one which says you are ethically driven and bounded by the need to address reparatory justice as an urgent need. And that reparatory justice will include looking at an estimate of the harms associated with human degradation and suffering, the socio-ecological and economic degradation of these regions, and indeed, all this has to be steered along a plane that says repair and renewal is what reparatory justice should look like in public. Reparatory justice, and how it will look like in private, will take the form of the apologies, will take the form of building bridges, people-to-people bridges, but with African countries, West Africa particularly, you know, there are also psychological repair that Rastafari, indigenous people, and others make that comes to, that speaks to what reparatory justice should look like for every person. And it should involve re-engagement with lands, re-engagement with Mother Africa, et cetera, et cetera. But what reparatory justice should look like in public should take the form of recompense in the direction of repair and renewal of these economies and these societies and descendants who find themselves structurally at the structurally poor, structurally suffering from the loss of not having intergenerational wealth, et cetera, et cetera. So the watchwords for me is about repair and renewal, and especially exciting is the quantum leap made in attempts to cost and estimate what those harms entailed, while humbly suggesting these figures, no matter how much trillions, cannot really be seen as representative of the kinds of psychological damages that continue to be inflicted on people of color and on the fact that they find themselves so structurally locked out because their life chances are overdetermined by race and color and how that works in a world order dominated by white supremacist logics. I will yield at this point, sorry.
You're still muted, Adrian.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Okay, sorry about that. Chantal, I'll assume that I just should start happened with our last speaker. First of all, I'm very, very delighted to thank all of the organizers for this event, especially His Excellency Judge Robinson and his incredible leadership. Thanks also to ASIL President Gregory Schaefer, who addressed us this morning, and staffer West Rist, who just intervened at this moment when I was still in mute. I'd also like to thank the University of West Indies and Professor Vereen Shepherd. I actually wish this event was live there in Iowa right now. It's below freezing, and I have enjoyed my visits to your campus. And of course, we have the very hardworking organizers, Natalie Reed and Professor Chantal Thomas. And I'm, of course, delighted to be joined by my co-panelists, Professor Mamadou Evie and Professor Don Marshall. Also speaking today as the co-founder and former co-chair of BASIL, Blacks of ASIL. As I hope many of you know, BASIL was started in 2014, and it has had a rich history of involvement in ASIL activities. And my fellow BASIL co-founder, the Honorable Gabrielle Kirk McDonald, who was also an honorary president of ASIL, and also, as I'm sure everyone knows, a former president of ICTY. Her spirit is here with us. I don't know if she's online or not. So BASIL is very pleased to be involved with this event. and I enjoyed being involved in the 2021 conference, where I had the pleasure of introducing Sir Hillary, who this morning gave us some very profound comments. I relate very personally to this topic of reparations as the descendant of slaves in the United States. On the other hand, I realize my own privilege as I am a tenured chaired professor at the University of Iowa, and I've been here for 36 years, and I am a third generation college graduate. Yet, as the statistics have presented, my group, African Americans, remains disproportionately lacking wealth, in large part due not only to what happened during the slavery period, but of course the subsequent subjugation that the report definitely highlights. My seven children and my 19 grandchildren face racism every day in the United States. It hasn't stopped. My partner, James Somerville, who is 65 years old and a dark-skinned African-American, has faced even more discrimination than I have as a light-skinned African-American, and we face this every day. I also have family from Korea.
Adrian, you were muted again for some reason. I don't know what happened.
Okay. Did you hear me mention James?
Yes. You were just saying you have family from, and then you got cut off.
Okay, good. I don't know why it did that, but I have family from the Caribbean as well as from Africa. I have indigenous roots, and also I have white ancestry. The nearest white relative to our knowledge is my great-great-grandfather. So I represent a melange of people that is very typical of many, many African Americans. Also, I was formerly involved with the National Conference of Black Lawyers for many years, and we were deeply involved in issues of reparations, working with groups like NCOBRA and others. And it is a shame that 40 years after my own personal involvement, that we are still discussing these issues. On the other hand, we know we're discussing issues that have occurred over 400 years. So we're actually making progress that we are at this point where Brattle has produced an incredible draft trying to quantify the unquantifiable. So what I'm going to focus on is intersectionality. As Chantal Thomas said when she introduced me, I am the editor of two readers, one called Critical Race Feminism and the other is Global Critical Race Feminism. Both of them involve the status of women of color, whether they be in the United States or in other countries. The report doesn't mention this, but Professor Kimberly Crenshaw of UCLA and Columbia Law Schools is well known globally for bringing this intersectional commentary into the legal academy and the writing therein. And so I was delighted to see the report actually had several references intersectionality in, and you often don't get reports at all that even comment on that. But I'm always pushing more. So for instance, I was glad to see a subsection of that has to do with the gender-based violence, and I appreciated the presentation where there was an attempt to quantify the gender-based violence. But I there's a way that we can try to push it in further. And it's not an additive process. but in my writing, I call it a multiplicative process. So you have to look at not, you know, plus female and then a few things happen to those females, but the multiplier effect of having to look at not only race, not only gender, but also color, pregnancy status, parent status, marital status, age, class, and other health statuses, all will be intersecting, affecting the women that we are concerned with in particular. Of course, we know in many cases they were not permitted to keep their children, the families were separated, et cetera. I was interested to hear of in the Caribbean when they needed to increase the population and couldn't get fresh slaves, that some places did some incentives to try to increase the population. And in the U.S., we all know example of the slave owners raping many of their female slaves as a means of increasing the population, along with them forcing sex between the slaves. So I'm not sure of the answers, but somehow this needs to be fleshed out, because when I looked at the number of the amount listed for sexual violence, I thought it was actually a bit low in these large numbers. And then I think somewhere it says there's maybe 58% of the women may have been sexually assaulted, and I don't know where that number would really come from, but why wouldn't we presume 100% of the people are sexually assaulted? And I said the people, because we can't forget the other side of the gender issue, that there are countless incidents where men were also sexually assaulted, and yet a lot of that gets suppressed. And then there also could be examples of homosexuality among the slave owners and whatever they might have felt they could get away with respect to their male slaves. And so we need to note or have something that the sexual violence can also be directed, as it can be now, to men. There's also something about children over 15 and assaults, et cetera. And we know children under 15 can be assaulted as well. And, of course, in earlier eras, even in a society where there any of this violence, you might have sexual activity or marriages occurring with children much younger than 15. And so there would be a need to get deal with younger, maybe perhaps younger ages than had been considered here. Another concept, my second concept I wanted to focus on briefly, is the non-quantifiable, which I have called in my own work spirit injury, that emotional and spiritual side of injury, which although it's hard to quantify, there are occasions where it can be. And so in U.S. law, for instance, you have the concept of intentional infliction of emotional distress, and they will quantify that, maybe not enough, but perhaps there is some way to work out numbers for this kind of a era. You know, and when you imagine the multiplicity of loss, when you have lost your family, participation in your community, in your clan or your ethnic group, in your religion, right, being ripped out of their religions, their customs, the languages, food, the music, the clothing, the education, the wealth, the status, all of that in one sense could be looked at as unquantifiable, but perhaps we need to think about ways where we could quantify at least part of that. We have to at least try, I think, but even if we come up with a number, let's say it's, I don't know, 100 trillion or 200 trillion, of course, our next step is who can we get, what entities, what governments can we get to pay even fractions of this amount? And, of course, even more, who do they pay it to? Do you pay it to the whole government of a country, to non-governmental organizations, or some other type of entity to try to figure out what to do with for sum of money it is, and what do we do about the blowback that will no doubt be in many countries? People will say, well, the person wasn't a slave. She's, you know, a fancy law professor. Why don't she or people like her get any money? And if it goes to a group, well, you know, is it misused? So all of those critiques of reparations that are out there, we would have to deal with. And even say, well, a government should owe it. I was involved with South Africa and the constitution-making process there. And so, as you know, they had Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and there was a little part that reparations. Well, the government, the post-apartheid government of South Africa, didn't have the money to pay all of the black people who had had land stripped from them and their ancestors by the prior white government. So, you know, holding a government liable if it's a poor country, it's not going to work. But all of us enjoy going to London and Paris and experiencing all the riches that those countries have had, a lot of it based on the facts of our ancestors. So in closing, I just want to say this is a wonderful start, and I look forward to seeing the later drafts and also to participating in the rest of this symposium tomorrow. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Adrienne, and thanks to all of the speakers. My apology for the error in introducing you. I'm sorry to have added that element of confusion and distracted from what has been a brilliant series of presentations. Thank you all for truly insightful remarks and for continuing this dialogue. We do have a few moments that remain, and I would like to ask each of the speakers whether you would like to expand on any of your earlier remarks, or in particular, if you'd like to pose any questions to the other speakers based on the other presentations. So I'd just like to open the floor now. Adrienne.
I agree with what Professor Ebier said, that, you know, looking in depth at the situation in Africa today is quite critical. And I don't know if that can be added to this project or a totally separate project. And of course, the African Union and others may need to be more involved, but clearly, that part of it, I would love to see this kind of quantification begin to be attempted. And maybe it's already out there and I just haven't seen it yet. So if any of you know, or anybody listening, I'd like to know if there is something like that out there.
Mamadou, would you want to speak to that? I was also very interested in that element of your remarks. Today we speak about human capital, and one could think about the loss of human capital in terms of the depopulation of African territories as one potential element of quantification of damage. I think there immediately I also think about possible objections that might be raised in terms of shared responsibility. We sometimes hear about you know, sometimes as a sort of a politicized distraction from conversations around reparations, claims of shared responsibility for transatlantic chattel slave trade across European and African territories. But I think in general that is such a fascinating question. So I'd love to hear as well any other remarks you might have. I also see that Judge Robinson has raised a hand and would like to ask a question. So perhaps we could also hear from Judge Robinson and then see if we have some time for any additional remarks. Judge Robinson? You have the floor, Judge Robinson. And I see that you're unmuted, but I don't think we're getting any audio.
Having difficulty.
Okay, so maybe I can turn the floor for the moment back to Mamadou if you wanted to respond to the previous line of questioning.
I think that the African part of the report would be interesting. It would be definitely fascinating. And I also agree with Adrian that the AU should take leadership in that in that respect. I don't believe that the claims that African countries were or African people were complicit in the enslavement. It was really an entire dynamic. If you look at the beginning of the slavery and the slave trade, you had African polities, kingdoms fighting against it. But the slave traders managed to disrupt the traditional structures and to engage in new dynamic, which allowed the trade to last for a number of years, centuries actually. So I don't think that this will be the major obstacle. I agree with you that we could think about the loss of human capital, but it's not only that. You have to realize that slave trade, by extinguishing all those entities which were trying to constitute themselves as states and empire, created a gap of political organization, which facilitated colonialism in the 18th and the 19th century. And even today, when you look, for instance, at areas such as Mali, Burkina Faso, Niger, which were the areas where people run from the coast and slave traders in order to go interland. These are, again, the same areas where you struggle to have a strong political organization, where you have jihadi groups and entering as almost at will. So it is a phenomenon that had strong disrupting consequences in the entire. So again, another anecdote that I can tell you. Even now in Burkina Faso, we have an expression in Jula language, which is a language which is spoken in Burkina Faso, in Mali, in Niger, in Senegal, in Guinea, in Cote d'Ivoire, in almost all West Africa. It's the most spoken language in West Africa. And we still have an expression, and I will say it in Jula, Niakembiferi, which is to say, if you do, I will sell you. You see, it is still there. It is still there, saying, oh, this idea that we could be selling each other is still there. And this lack of trust, this lack of confidence, cannot allow strong political organization, a strong economy. No one wants to trust the other. And all this has to find its roots in the in the slave experience. So how will you be able to erase all this traumatic past? How will you be able to find ways to compensate for it? I don't necessarily believe that we have to try to identify breaches of international law and establish a duty to compensate. What I really proposed here is to say, you found your original capital to develop here. Now you are developed and we are happy about it. It's good. Now bring back the original capital so that we could also pursue development. It's true our destinies have been disrupted for 3, 4, 5 centuries, but now we have the opportunity to write a different story, and you can contribute to it because you benefited from it. And of course, even if you don't pay the money, at least show good will, show good effort by removing all the hidden shackles in the international economy, which is still keeping African countries poor and exploited.
We could continue this conversation, I think, for many hours, if not days, but luckily the conversation will continue. We'll reconvene tomorrow. I believe that we must close the session in order to keep to time. Perhaps I'll just give an opportunity for any closing remarks or final observations from the speakers.
Yeah, thank you.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, thank you very much. I do believe that there is the possibility of several kinds of emancipatory projects, reparations projects that could be undertaken simultaneously. I do think that the work to bring West Africa squarely into the picture is urgent work. It's urgent epistemologically speaking, even because the basis upon which we can understand each other and shape and control narratives is a critical first step to winning hearts and minds. So there is a prevailing perception of collusion, culpability, and so on, that has been established not by anecdotes or fables, but that has been established through the venerable writings within Eurocentric circles and universities and so on. And there's a way in which that has to be addressed head on. We must have the engagement. We must have a confrontation with those kinds of narratives deliberately, so that we can truly identify, there may have been complicit leaders and regimes, but that does not speak for the continent. It does not speak for whole countries. It does not speak for the resistance from below civil society across West Africa, in abject outrage against being traumatized and re-traumatized with the threat of being sent, as the brother just spoke, being sent to, you know? So we need to know more if we're to understand ourselves and how racialized systems of wealth and advantage become consecrated as a common sense force in our lives, right?
Well said. We've heard about so many different aspects, from epistemological, moral, the philosophical, as well as the institutional, the legal, the economic, the empirical. So it really has been a very rich set of interventions in this session, and we encourage everyone to join us tomorrow for the continuation of this symposium. The session tomorrow will be convening at 10 a.m. Eastern Time in Jamaica time, and you can refer to the website asl.org/events/reparations for more details. Thank you again to the speakers. Thank you to Judge Robinson, to Sir Hilary Beckles, to Greg Schaefer, to Dr. Vereen Shepherd. Thanks to all of you, and I will bid you goodbye for today.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to everyone joining us for this, the second day of the second symposium on reparations under international law, for transatlantic chattel slavery in the Americas and the Caribbean. This is the final day of the second of two symposia, and we are delighted that you could join us again. For those who are just joining us and were not able to tune in yesterday or to view the video yesterday, we will begin with a short summary of what happened yesterday during the first day of the symposium. First, allow me to introduce myself. My name is Natalie Reed, and I have the pleasure and privilege of being one of the organizers of the symposium. Yesterday, during the first day of the symposium, Judge Robinson reminded us of the conclusions of the last symposium, which established that transatlantic chattel slavery was unlawful at the time it was committed, and that as a result, former slaveholding countries have an obligation to make full reparation under international law to the descendants of Africans they enslaved, but that neither that determination nor the calculation of the amounts due can be left up to the perpetrators. Beyond monetary payment, international law also requires that satisfaction be given, including if compensation would not be sufficient to fully remedy the wrongs. That satisfaction could, of course, include a formal apology and depends upon the nature of the wrongs in question. It may include, of course, consideration of whether, for example, the psychological harms that were suffered by those who were enslaved may be appropriately addressed by monetary compensation or by some other form of remedial step. Judge Robinson also discussed recent developments in between the first symposium and this symposium, such as acknowledgments from governmental and major institutions of European countries, and noted that these had been a positive step. For example, the apology offered by the Prime Minister of the Netherlands, but that the steps that had been discussed publicly in recent times may well be insufficient to fully redress the harms committed during transatlantic chattel slavery and the consequences, the enduring legacy of transatlantic chattel slavery that we continue to see and feel today. We then heard a powerful keynote address from Sir Hilary Beckles, Vice Chancellor of the University of the West Indies, who explained that the impacts and the consequences, again, of transatlantic chattel slavery, not solely from a legal perspective, but also from a historical one. And from that historical perspective, discussed whether and how transatlantic chattel slavery at different times could be considered to have been a form of genocide against the populations involved. Sir Hilary elaborated on the situation that enslaved peoples were left with after slavery formally ended. And in response to questions and observations from Judge Robinson, offered insightful comments on whether and how those who are seeking now to grapple with the consequences of transatlantic chattel slavery, including the legal qualification as genocide or other breaches of international law, could infer intent behind slave owners' conduct and policies throughout the relevant period in the Caribbean and throughout the Americas. We then heard from the economists of the Brattle Group, who presented in a briefer form than the report, which is also available from the webpage for the symposium, the estimate, the calculations, the quantification they had prepared of reparations due first for the period during transatlantic chattel slavery, and second for the period after transatlantic chattel slavery. The colleagues from the Brattle Group, Dr. Vargas and Dr. Bazelon, in addition to presenting those figures, really grappled with the idea of the scale of those figures and provided some context and perspective on how the sheer mind-boggling, in some ways, sums involved really reflect both the number of those who were the initial victims of transatlantic chattel slavery, the period over which the breaches of international law were committed, and of course, the important consequence of the passage of time since those initial breaches were committed. Among the heads of damage that the Brattle team considered of course, as guided by Judge Robinson's legal framework, were damages for loss of life, uncompensated labor, loss of liberty, gender-based violence, and for the period after transatlantic chattel slavery, using wealth disparity as a method of capturing a number of different harms that we continue to see today. We then had our first panel of discussants with Dr. Mamadou Edie, Professor Don Marshall, and Professor Adrian Wayne, who discussed the analysis that had been presented by the Brattle Group, but also took a broader perspective and highlighted the differences between, for example, the economic approach and the legal approach to damages, reminding us that we could also consider whether and how reparations are owed to the African states, and emphasizing that reparative justice must be ethically driven and not solely economically driven, as well as pushing us to take significant considerations, such as really building on gender-based violence assessments and intersectionality in those considerations, whether and how to take those further into account in the calculation. Today, we are delighted to welcome additional esteemed discussants to continue this discussion. And we will hear from Judge Abdulkawi Ahmed Yusuf, member and former president of the International Court of Justice, Dr. Mutaba Kasazi, former executive head of the United Nations Compensation Commission. We will then hear some additional comments from Professor Vereen Shepherd, the director of the Center for Reparation Research at the University of the West Indies, who of course has been a key participant in both symposia, is a member of the advisory committee convened by Judge Robinson for this symposium. And then we will hear some concluding remarks from Judge Robinson himself to wrap up the day and this symposium. To introduce our discussants, again, their biographical summaries are available from the webpage for the symposium. But I will very briefly introduce them, and then we will move directly to hearing from each of them. So Judge Yusuf, as I mentioned, is very well known to many of us in the international community as former president and remaining a member of the International Court of Justice, where he has served on the court since 2009. Judge Yusuf, of course, has spent many decades of service to Somalia and to the international community. From 1975 to 1980, he served as Somalia's delegate to the third UN Conference on the Law of the Sea. He, of course, has taught and written extensively, including from the 1970s onwards. From 1987 to 1992, Judge Yusuf was chief of the Legal Policy Service of the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, UNCTAD, before becoming its representative and head of its New York office from 1992 to 1994. From 1994 to 2001, he served as legal advisor up to 1998, and then assistant director for African affairs for the United Nations Industrial Development Organization in Vienna. From March 2001 to January 2009, Judge Yusuf was legal advisor and director of the Office of International Standards and Legal Affairs for the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, UNESCO. In 2001, Judge Yusuf joined the Advisory Council of the Hague Institute, in 2011, joined the Advisory Council of the Hague Institute for Global Justice. Judge Yusuf, of course, as part of his distinguished academic career, has been founder and general editor of the African Yearbook of International Law, and is a member of the Institut de Droit International. He is one of the founders of the African Foundation for International Law and chairman of its executive committee. Judge Yusuf, we are delighted and honored that you will join us this morning and this afternoon. Dr. Mutaba Kasazi, as I mentioned, is former executive head of the United Nations Compensation Commission, and of course was instrumental in setting up the UNCC and in resolving 2.7 million claims from over 100 countries. He's also recently served as the executive commissioner of two international mass claims programs for payment of compensation to workers. Dr. Kasazi has had as well a long and distinguished career in national and international service, having been a former judge in the courts of Tehran and worked extensively on the arbitration and settlement of claims before the Iran-US Claims Tribunal. He's also served as a vice president of the Instituto Internacional and as a visiting scholar at the Graduate Institute in Geneva. Dr. Kasazi currently sits as an independent arbitrator in different disputes and serves as a board member of the Tehran Regional Arbitration Center. Dr. Kasazi, we are as well delighted and honored that you're able to join us today. So, Judge Youssef, if I may turn to you first, we welcome your comments and observations on the points made in the Brattle report, and more broadly on the question of reparations for transatlantic chattel slavery under international law. I believe that you are currently on mute, sir, so if the administrator could take Judge Youssef off mute.
No, I think I...
Yes,
it's fine.
Excellent. We can now hear you.
I have
the floor is yours, Judge Youssef.
Yeah. Thank you very much. And I will not take much time because I don't really have a lot to say about the report. I think it is a groundbreaking report. And I believe that that groundbreaking possibility was also offered and facilitated by the first symposium and the legal guidance and legal framework paper that was prepared by Judge Robinson. Because I think Judge Robinson's paper gives us the legal basis on which discussions and debates on reparations can actually be engaged and can be pursued, because it clarifies the legal issues arising from the chattel slavery of Africans several centuries ago. And of course, it is continued effects and impact on the descendants of the slaves and on the people who live in many parts of the world who were unwillingly and forcefully uprooted, transported and used as uncompensated labor in plantations to produce for the benefit of economies in the Northern Hemisphere. And I think that in your summary, you just mentioned that one, of course, of the speaker is mentioned yesterday that slavery could also be considered as a genocide. I think we should stay away from that. I say we should stay away from that because slavery was undertaken because the slaves or the enslaved persons were needed actually as uncompensated labor. So there was no intent to get rid of them. And those who died were actually a loss to the slave owners because these people were treated as goods and as goods which could actually provide services. Not just, they were not commodities only because they were dehumanized, but they were commodities that could offer services which can be monetized. And therefore, they were useful for those who engaged in slavery. And the intention of the slave owners could not be and was actually far away from an intention to get rid of them or to destroy them as human beings. They were very useful for them, and therefore they wanted to keep them alive. And that was also part of the trade, because they were being used as tradable commodities. And you don't want your tradable commodities to be destroyed or lost. Now, some of the major issues that have been raised by the report of the Prattle Group, actually my attention was drawn to the fact that I think it is in the last page of the report. No, it is on page 70 of the report. There was a placeholder on proportional and allocation needs to be revised. And there was also a reference to the countries which by whom countries which owe the 100 trillion in reparations. So the reference read is the more than 100 trillion in reparation is owed, are not owed by a single country. And I think we have to revisit this kind of remarks, and I will place them actually in the context of the entire discussion, because I think it is very important to address not only by whom the reparations are owed, but to whom they are owed. And maybe it is much more difficult. It's not that easy in any case to establish to whom they are owed. And that is not also very clear either in the original papers or in the Prattle Group papers. And if we take, for example, loss of life, we will have to see where those lives were lost. Were they lost immediately after the capture of the enslaved persons? Were they lost in the dungeons in which the slaves were kept before embarkation and shipment? Or were they lost in the middle passage? Or were they lost in the plantations or in the slave labor camps where many of these people were used as slaves? I think it is very important that these issues be addressed, because then, of course, those to whom the reparations are owed will be different. Whether the reparations are owed to African communities who are still in Africa, or whether the reparations are owed to communities who are in the diaspora, African diaspora who are the descendants of slaves. And the other important question with respect to whom it is owed, the reparations are owed, is actually, are the reparations owed to a country or to a state, or are the reparations owed to a community or a collectivity, or are the reparations owed to individuals? And that's very important also, because I think that this needs to be discussed and to be clarified, because it will be different in each of these instances what kind of reparations will have to be considered for different categories of for different entities to which the reparation may be owed. Then I come to the two categories, or in the case of the paper, I think that was originally prepared by Judge Robinson. Actually, there were three categories of reparations, I think. Reparations for consequences of the wrongful conduct of transatlantic shuttle slavery in the period following its formal termination. That was the first category. And then there were two categories of reparations for the continuing breach of the obligations owed in respect of transatlantic shuttle slavery. One for the period in which these persons were still kept as slaves, or were actually still being treated as slaves, although the legislation, there was legislation which actually terminated slavery, and therefore they were not being traded, but they were still being treated as slaves. And one continuation which concerns, as I understand it, discrimination against the former enslaved persons and their descendants. And in the Prattel group, I think there are two major categories. Reparation is for the enslaved and the persons who were subjected to slavery and to uncompensated labor and who were deprived of their liberty, etc., and who were subjected also to sexual violence and assaults, and reparations for continuing breach of the obligation through the treatment, discriminatory treatment, meted out to the descendants. And for the first one, the Prattel group made a quantification of about, I think, 78.7 trillion, while for the second, they made a quantum of 22.6 trillion. And of course, these are huge amounts of money. But before actually dealing with these amounts of money, one has to deal with the purpose and objective of the reparation, for example, in the first case, in the case of the reparation is for loss of life, for uncompensated labor, etc. What would be the purpose? Would the purpose be to compensate those who are alive today and who are the descendants of the slaves and to pay them for the treatment that was meted out to their ancestors? Or is the purpose to compensate the communities from which these persons were taken and which were deprived of these people as a community and which suffered, of course, because of the fact that a part of their population was taken away by force and shipped to far-off lands. So that is one issue. The second issue is to whom would this compensation be paid? As I said before, I think it's not easy to determine that. And whether it is states, collectivities, and for what purpose would it be used in any case? And I think, therefore, that the focus should not be on this first type of reparation in the form of compensation. I think the focus, in my view, should be on the second type of reparation, which would not be only in the form of compensation, but which would also be in the form of satisfaction. Although, of course, satisfaction could also be applied to the first form of reparation. Why do I say that we should focus on the second? Because I think that there are millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people who are still suffering, hundreds of millions, in fact, who are still suffering from the effects of slavery. And I think it's not only Article 14.2 of the ILC articles to which Judge Robinson referred in his paper, but I think it is very important to keep in mind Article 30 of the ILC articles on state responsibility, which actually says that the state responsible for the internationally wrongful act is under an obligation to cease that act if it is continuing. To cease that act if it is continuing. And since, of course, and I agree with Judge Robinson, that there is a continuing breach of an obligation and that the acts of slavery are continuing in the form of discriminatory treatment of the descendants of the slaves, it would be very important today to ensure the cessation of those acts. And the cessation of those acts will not only come through compensation. It will not, in my view. It will come, I think, mainly through satisfaction. And I am talking here about satisfaction in the form of, for example, a correct account of what happened, an accurate account of the violations. That's what I mean, an accurate account of the violations, and the inclusion of that accurate account of the violations in educational material at all levels throughout the world and throughout those countries where slavery was practiced. And I think this is extremely important. And it is also important to have as another form of satisfaction a public disclosure of the truth about slavery. Because I don't think that many of the societies are aware and know the truth about slavery. Of course, for example, now in the Netherlands, there was a report about slavery, and as a result of that report, the Prime Minister offered apologies. But are the conclusions and the facts that have been established through that report, are they going to be part of the curriculum that is taught in schools in the Netherlands? Is there going to be an accurate account of what the Dutch slave owners did and how the Dutch East Indies Company behaved and conducted itself in the acquisition and in the trade, in the slave trade? So those are, to me, an extremely important consideration is to be kept in mind. And I think those considerations will have to relate to the post-enslavement period and the continuing breach of the obligation, the discriminatory treatment of the descendants of the slaves, and the need for cessation, because this should finally somehow come to an end, and unless it comes to an end, no amount of compensation will be able to repair and to remedy the damage done. And I think I will stop there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Judge Yusuf, for those observations, the questions raised, the points made. While you were speaking, you had referred to a table in the Brattle report, and we briefly showed that table. If I could ask Mr. Rist to show the table again, just so that our colleagues watching on Zoom and the YouTube feed can see it. The report is, of course, available from the symposium website, and the particular table that Judge Yusuf was referring to is table 29 in the report, which is now on your screen. I would encourage anyone watching to review the full report, including this table, and of course the tables, the figures, and the analysis set out in the in full in the report, to understand how the Brattle team developed the figures. And of course, we look forward to hearing from Judge Robinson in closing remarks, in thinking about how some of the questions and considerations raised by the discussants, including those yesterday and Judge Yusuf now, will be taken into account going forward. We now turn to Dr. Kasazi. Again, we are indeed Honored to have you with us today, Dr. Kasazi, with your extensive experience in dealing with mass claims under international law. The floor is yours, sir, to provide your comments and observations.
Thank you very much, Ms. Reed, for the introduction, but also for the excellent summary that you made of the proceedings of yesterday and the important point that you highlighted. Good afternoon and good day to everyone. I am very pleased and honored to participate at this symposium and be a member of this panel with Judge Yusuf. And I just enjoyed very much listening to him and to his thought-provoking presentations and the issues that he raised. I would have liked to make some comments on that, but I don't think I have time. I leave them for Judge Robinson. The purpose of the Brattle Group report, which we are reviewing here, is to quantify and put monetary value on all the harms and damages caused by transatlantic chattel slavery. This is, of course, a very difficult and challenging task that the authors have referred to it with expressions such as seemingly insurmountable and hopeless. Nevertheless, they have managed to harness this complicated task very well, and with the help of their own knowledge and research and benefiting from the available academic literature and the body of work already done by many researchers and scholars on this issue in the last few decades, it seems that the authors have become confident enough to make a number of good assumptions on key issues that were necessary in order to arrive at a reasonable and convincing results. And I commend them for that. The task, of course, is not finished, and there are areas to refine and reinforce and to add more diverse backgrounds and statistics to the report. And to go back again to what Judge Yusuf mentioned, I think some of those comments have also added some needs for extra review of the report and fine-tuning them. With the time available, I would like to mainly address three, four important issues. First, I like to look at the main methodology and model with the material assumptions, which have far-reaching effect on the quantum of compensation. This is, in fact, the part that deals with the loss of life and uncompensated labor. Also, for the same reason, I like to review the interest rate and its impact on the quantification of compensation. And finally, to look at what is not in the report and perhaps should be there. The authors themselves have been very open and transparent on the shortcomings and the limitations of the report. The most obvious and important unquantified element of loss is the one that yesterday Judge Patrick Robinson highlighted, i.e. psychological harm. I like to discuss this matter in light of the practice of the United Nations Compensation Commission, where mental pain and anguish was calculated and compensated for thousands of victims of military operations. And I don't see any reason that we shouldn't be able to do it here. Before starting on these items, I like to emphasize the importance of the statement that the authors of the report have rightly made in page 11 of the report, where the report says, quote, "There is no amount of money that would repair the harm of the enslaving millions of Africans and their descendants." The authors have also included a thoughtful quote from Professor Shepherd on that matter. I like to associate myself fully with both the statements of the authors and Professor Shepherd. Now, overview of economic framework, if we can go to page 13 of the report, that would facilitate the presentation.
I believe it is PDF page 13, printed page 8 of the report.
Thank you very much. A brief comment here. The quote from the Human Rights Commission is fine here. However, it seems to me it will be more appropriate to add or even to start with reference to the work of the International Law Commission on the draft articles on state responsibility for internationally wrongful acts. Yesterday, Judge Robinson, in his systematic approach on legal issues, summarized the relevant articles. Those articles could be added here. In addition, I would also add Article 38 that confirms that interest is part of compensation and should be calculated to ensure full reparation, and that the rate and mode of calculation should be set to achieve that purpose. I would also add now, in light of what Judge Youssef said, the article mentioned, the article that he referred to on the same set of draft articles that refers to the obligation to seize the wrongful act and the cessation. That would be important to be mentioned here as well. If we can go to the next page, please. The table one. This is an important table here that shows the interest rates over centuries. I agree with the approach taken in the report that inflation, it has calculated the inflation separately from the real interest. The obvious reason, and the reason for this approach, is that inflation, as was explained yesterday, is in fact the main component of the interest rate, of the nominal interest rate. When we take inflation out of the what we recognize generally as interest, what remains comprises real interest rate and risks. That risk referred to as political risk. Now, political risk, or generally risk, I don't think are accounted for here, and yesterday Dr. Bazilon confirmed that it is because it has been assumed that the countries involved are able to pay and there's no risk. I think it's possible to view the situation differently because the risk is more general than that, it seems to me. And for me, any debt that has not been paid for a long time, here it is hundreds of years, is a risky debt. So I leave this as a question for the authors of the report and whether it would have any impact on the calculation or not. The other point here on this for the table is that the shortcut that the authors have found for avoiding a long and complicated calculation of interest is very helpful. At the same time, as explained later in the report, the bulk of the calculated compensation is on interest because of the length of time, which is quite unusual and is exceptional because of the circumstances here, because of the long period of time that has passed. So it is important that the calculation be reliable for such a heavy weight that we are going to put on that. And finally, I see that the rates, it's on the question of the interest rate use, I see that the rates in the table are all much higher than 2.5% used in the report. Also, in the two paragraphs below the tables on the same page, I see that a slight contradiction. The first paragraph says that the 3% nominal interest rate used in the literature is lower than the average rate and would be a conservative and reasonable rate. So 3% is okay. However, in the second paragraph, the report calculates a nominal rate of 2.5%. We will come back to this issue of interest at the later part of the report when we look at hopefully table 30. Now, if we can go to loss of life and uncompensated labor and go to page 24 on the version that I have. Loss of life and uncompensated labor accounts for the main portion of the total calculated compensation. By quantifying these two important elements of loss together and applying a common methodology on both, the authors have saved lots of time and have made an amazing shortcut, which has resolved lots of issues. Not to mention that apparently this was also necessary, this imaginative way to avoid the problem of lack or shortage of data. The main assumptions that have been used here are, first of all, they have to make an important choice between the value of a statistical life methodology and loss of productive life methodology. I agree with their choice, which is the second one, which simply means, as you know, that taking the earning of the deceased and extrapolates that into the future to the earning, expected earning period on the basis of the life expectancy, and then calculate the compensation on that basis. I think this is the right choice that they have made, also because of the, I refer to International Labor Organization's Employment Injury Benefit Convention number 121, which is very well known in ILO and in the labor organizations, which follows the same methodology and do that. And in fact, we and I personally use this for the calculation of compensation for the victims of the Rana Plaza disaster in Dhaka, and also for the victims and for the injured and deceased workers from the Tazreen fashion company fire, which was a big loss. And finally, in UN Compensation Commission, where there was a need to calculate loss of life for a large number of people, this was the method that was used also based on the precedent. Now, if we continue, the main assumptions that have been necessary for these two elements of loss, the first one is the number, the total number, how many enslaved persons were involved. As you see in the report, there has been a relatively a good portion allocated to these, and it tells me that the authors were fully aware of the importance of this figure, and they have documented it very well. Now, if we please can look at figure 4, in my version, it is on page 26. Yes, thank you. This shows a good portion of the methodology that has been applied. The life expectancy for enslaved, for non-enslaved, and then loss of life. This is what I call the genius, because the way this has been calculated, the authors didn't have to calculate separately for the deceased. And in fact, they have calculated for all the 20 million enslaved that they have calculated. And they have assumed that everyone was alive until the end period of the life expectancy of a non-slave person. And with that, they have come up with all the figures that have. This means, of course, for compensation for I'm sorry to use these words, for the live and dead have been calculated the same. They have been treated the same, which is a feature in a way of the mass claims processing. After this, the authors have continued with the modeling assumptions, which you can see two pages later, and you will see there that they have discussed how many hours they should have used, how to calculate the day, and at the end they have agreed on a 12-hour day and 7 days per week, which is correct in my view. And then the most important figure for me in the whole report comes out in page 78. I'm sorry, in page 28. This is the amount of wage of a worker and for 1 day. 0.78 of dollar per day. This seems small, but this is the basis of all the 54 trillion calculations that comes later. So for me, this is very important that this figure be really justified and well established and supported. And page 31, table 3, which shows the total amount that, as was mentioned, amounts to 55 trillion for the loss of life and uncompensated later. In table 4, which is in page 32, the authors have shown the sensitivity to assumptions, which comes from the interest rate in that. And you see that the 54.8 trillion goes at the middle and relates on two criteria. One is the rate of interest, 2.5, which includes inflation and real rate of interest. And the other one is the non-US wage proportion to a US wage. In this situation, it has been assumed that the wage are the same and they are 100%, so they are the same wage. It comes to this, which seems conservative. As I said, it seems that the interest has room to change a bit because of the risk and because of the comparison, but otherwise it seems fine here. Now, and my conclusion on this part, very briefly, the methodology used as a whole resembles mass claims methodology, but at the same time, it misses some important elements that normally we see in the mass claims processing. I'm not saying this is because of the authors. Most of these, I'm sure, could be explained because of the situation and because of the lack of information and the vastness of the task. The steps that in a standard claims processing one normally sees is sampling. When you have a large population, a huge population like here, you will take a sample, you will study the sample, then you try to make sure that you have a representative sample, and that representative sample will be decided by a statistician who will take into account the total population and then the number of what would be representative. Then you would work on profiling on this sample and prepare some general profiles that could be applied to all the other, to the rest of the populations. This makes the task very easy, and it seems until here, this is in fact what the our authors of the report have done. What is not here probably is that at that stage, then you will have to do some regression analysis and go back a bit and look at the outliers, the ones who stand out. For instance, if you have taken into account in profiling that the salary of the workers were, $700, then you see there are some people who are asking for double and there are some people who are asking for lower. Then you will look at those outliers to find out the reason, see what was the reason. That we don't have here, probably because it was not possible, lack of information. That is, in this situation, unfortunately, that's always an explanation. In addition, which I'm hoping it will be this one, it was not needed. I mean that the population and the samples and the rest were so similar that there was no need to separate some of them and profile them and apply them, and there were no outliers. Now, if I like to go to the page 43 to 45, which is non-quantified harms.
It's on the screen.
Yes, thank you. Yes, this is the place that the authors explain that the psychological harm has not been calculated and put, but they also show that the lack of quantification is not an indication of the unimportance of these avenues of harm, and we therefore address them briefly below, which they refer to and all that. What I like to, not to take too much time, what I like to do is to go directly, Wes, please, to the other documents that I gave you. What I like to mention here is that in the United Nations Compensation Commission, that many of you know, it was set up in 1991 after the invasion of Kuwait by Iraq at the time, and the war by the Allies against Kuwait and liberation of Kuwait. An unprecedented compensation commission was set up by the United Nations the first time, and the Security Council was the governing body. The UNCC was a subsidiary organ of the Security Council. It had three organs: governing council, secretariat, commissioners. Governing Council was setting the policy, i.e. the Security Council. It was represented by the same membership, a secretariat that serves the Governing Council, and then panels of commissioners. We had 17 panels of commissioners of highly qualified jurists and other professions who decided on the claim. The secretariat prepared the work, and they decided on that. Question of mental pain and anguish, sorry, I use this because this is the way it was referred to, psychological harm in UNCC. It was called mental pain and anguish. It was one of the first issues that came up. You see that this is decision 8 of the Governing Council, which had about 300 decisions, so but this was one of the first one. And in fact, they decided in decision 3 on mental pain and anguish that there were no amounts, and asked the secretariat for a paper to explain how this could be done, and we did, and I worked myself on that a lot, and we prepared information for the governing council, and they came up with this decision. As you will see here in this, I opened my version, here, there are a number of mental pain and anguish that has been decided on and agreed on, and practically for any types of loss, apart from torture, hiding, hostage taking, witnessing, being subject to harm or witnessing harm to a family member, they are all been provided compensation for. The amounts and for the sexual assault, for instance, there is a mental pain and anguish, which is natural. And I use this opportunity to say that when yesterday on the first panel this issue came up, I fully agree that the number of female persons there should be in the report. I think it will be quite justified to be increased to 100%, but maybe for the men a percentage could be added. But you see that the UNCC, these are all there. In addition, the last one is very interesting, that one of the member of the council wanted to add at the end, that if someone is in a situation that is deprived of all economic resources and lots of difficulty, even that is a psychological harm, and there should be compensation for that, for that part. I leave you to read it later. It is available to the organizers. And I also remind you that decision 3 also is important. So read these two together. Now for here, I would suggest to do it the same way as was done at the time in UNCC. Of course, at that time, the current resources were not available. And now it's easier to make research and find more precedents to add this. The first stage should be to think about what should be the heads of losses for psychological harms. And then the second would be what should be the amount to be allocated for each of these harms. I like to stop here with a short conclusion. I think the report is an excellent report. A small point I hadn't mentioned, another issue that it doesn't mention, and yesterday also was not mentioned, what is the margin of error in this report? And normally, our authors have been very open, so they can mention that as well. And as you know, a percentage of, 4, 5, 6% in every report is normal. In this situation, I think it can even go higher and can go up to 10% or around 10%. So they shouldn't worry about that. I also want to mention that when I say that there is a need to prop up the reports more, to have background information, to add more statistics and all that. First of all, I don't mean to create work for the authors. Others can do that. Organizers can find a way to do it. But to do, and also the legal aspect, of course, to do that. And second, also, I am personally convinced that even with more work, the report will not, the result will not be much different. And that is one of the reasons, one of the important elements for mass claims processing. Mass claims processing is not an exact science. You will not pay each person the exact amount that they are owed. You pay them an approximate amount. But it's possible to pay an exact amount, but then they have to wait 5 years, 10 years for this term, for the processing and all that, for like the normal courts that it takes time. Here is the same. If you want a quick report and go that, then that's it. And the marginal error will be higher. Again, it's an excellent report, but there is room for some improvement and for some additions, and in particular and mainly the question of psychological harm or MPA, as it was called in the jargon of the UNCC. Thank you very much.
Dr. Kasazi, thank you very much for your contribution. I am sure that in addition to those of us who have been following and watching and those who are watching the YouTube stream, that our colleagues from the Brattle team were indeed watching very keenly and following your observations. And we may very well hear from them separately outside of the context of the symposium, of course. In terms of what can be made available to the public, thank you very much for pointing us towards the decisions of the UN Compensation Commission, including in mental pain, anguish, and suffering, and how that maps on to psychological harm. We can absolutely post those to the website as well. They are publicly available as they are UN documents, so they will be as available for consultation as the Brattle report itself is. We will now turn to Professor Shepherd, who, of course, whose contribution to both symposia, and in particular in her role as a historian, as an advocate in these issues for many years, has been incalculable to the subject of this symposium. Professor Shepherd, you have the floor.
Thank you very much. I will try to be brief. I just wanted to make a few comments on some of the issues raised yesterday and today. First of all, I really want to appreciate all the work that has gone into this by the Brattle Group and all the work that Judge Robinson and colleagues yesterday and today put into this effort. This is really marvelous. And Judge Robinson, thank you again for having asked me to play some role into the contents the contents already there and those that will be added. Now, yesterday we were talking about genocide because of the drastic population decline in the Caribbean. I wanted to just say that it is true, and I was listening keenly to Judge Yusuf. There was an anti-natalist policy in the Caribbean up to the abolition of the transatlantic trafficking in enslaved Africans. Well, the act anyway, because we know it continued illegally, still illegally, way beyond 1807 in the case of the British Caribbean. Now, the almost motto of these planters in the Caribbean was, it is cheaper to buy than to breed. And demographic historians have written about this for a long time. So the treatment was deliberate. The chattelization, the dehumanization, the construction of the codification of laws to declare our ancestors non-persons, all of that was deliberate. And death was not only because of disease, it was because of mistreatment, and it was because of deliberate killing. The Maroons, for example, waged an 80 years war against the British, and the casualty rate was high, I guess on both sides, but there was deliberate killing of protesters over the two centuries of the British being in the Caribbean. You have to look at what happened after every war of resistance to see the deliberate hanging, the murder of people. So I don't accept that we can't use genocide because it wasn't really deliberate what happened. It was almost like a casualty of the system. That's one. Then when we come to the post-slavery, the post-trafficking period, when there was suddenly a pro-natalist policy, we have to understand also that there was resistance to that by the enslaved. The planters in the post-1807 period in the British colonized Caribbean attempted to base the regeneration of the enslaved laboring population on women. So women's conditions would have been placed at the center of this sudden pronatalist policy. This would require the cooperation of women. And the literature, the historiography is replete with scholars on gender issues showing that women were not cooperating. They could have fed them some more. They could have taken them out of the field some more. They had control over their bodies. And so there was a deliberate attempt by enslaved women not to cooperate. In other words, what I'm saying is that we have to factor in these issues when we're talking just with figures. Figures alone can't tell the whole story. And that's why we have the work of people like Professor Barry Higman from the 1980s. He's a quantitative and demographic historian. And then when we come to talk about USA, sometimes I get the impression that we talk in glowing terms about pronatalist policy there and treatment. We have to remember that, and historians have written about this for a long time, when we talk about demographics, we have to consider the place that we're talking about. In other words, it is well known that the death rate was highest where enslaved people worked in the sugar plantation. However, there were contexts both in the U.S. and in the Caribbean where enslaved people did not work on sugar plantations. And it is shown that the demographics in those contexts would have been different from on the sugar plantation. Now, it may not have affected that much the overall population increase or decrease, but we have to be careful when we're generalizing across economic enterprises in the Caribbean. And then we have to also remember that part of what happened in the United States of America, and Fogel and Engerman have written about this for a long time ago, it was deliberate breeding. Some of it was deliberate breeding, because as the colonization continued, as the United States tried to open up to the West, my understanding from reading U.S. historians, some of them, is that there was an attempt to use enslaved, the regeneration of the enslaved population, to help to conquer new lands. And so, again, it wasn't because they liked enslaved people and wanted to treat them better. I think we have to nuance that kind of argument. And those were the, you know, the few comments. And maybe finally, again, I was reading the QC, Gifford, Anthony Gifford. And in defending reparation and looking at the legal aspects, he has said that there's no statute of limitation in talking about reparation for a crime against humanity. And I think we have already concluded that the whole trafficking and chattelization were illegal at the time they were committed, and that reparation is justified. And also in terms of the descendants and those living with the legacies, he also says that there is nothing in international law which prevents descendants of ancestors who never got compensation for claiming on behalf of their ancestors. So I hope that this could be maybe debated a little bit more. And then maybe I should also say that I agree with Judge Yusuf, and it is I'm a historian. It's a painful thing for me. Judge Robinson and I talk about this all the time. The way in which the education system is not preparing our children, each generation, to know what happened and to ensure that they pass on this knowledge. Caribbean history is not compulsory beyond a certain level, the lower levels in the schools. And even when it is done at the higher levels, it's a choice. We have been pushing to change this and John Yusuf is right. If the Dutch apology and what transpires this year does not filter down into the curriculum, if there's not curriculum reformation, then this will just stay and, you know, the old people will know and the young people won't know and so on. So this is an effort of quantification. It's just that surrounding it has to be a context, and this might not be a you know, numbers context. And then I listen carefully also to Judge Yusuf about to whom will this be paid, whatever the quantity, and how will it be used. And again, since 2013, the CARICOM heads of government tasked the CARICOM Reparation Commission with drawing up or answering just that question. And for the region, there's a 10-point plan which talks about why and who should be entitled, and how, and the avenues through which that repair should take place. So it's not a payout. It is apology. It is debt cancellation. It is technology transfer. It is attention to psychological harm, to education, to health, so that it's an infrastructure, social infrastructural blueprint or strategy towards repair. So I just wanted to throw out those comments, and again to thank everyone for this wonderful work. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Shepherd. Indeed, again, not just for those comments, but for your contribution to the work of the symposium and for your enduring work over the decades on these critical issues. We now turn for the closing remarks for this symposium to Judge Patrick Robinson, the chair of the symposium. Judge Robinson, you have the floor.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, I take the opportunity to thank all of the participants in the symposium, Sir Hilary Beckles, as well as all of those who discussed the Brattle Report, George Yusuf, Dr. Mamadou Hebi, Professor Adrian Wing, Dr. Mustafa Kazazi, and Dr. Don Marshall. Of course, on behalf of the symposium, I express my gratitude to the Brattle Group of Valuators for the very significant work they have done in producing this report. And if you'll allow me, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to mention that the work was done pro bono. I must also thank Professor David Eltis for his groundbreaking research on slave voyages, which has played a pivotal role in the symposium work on the quantification of reparations. And thanks are also due to Samantha Campbell and Michael Hilton, two young Jamaicans who prepared valuable tables which assisted the Brattle Group in its work. I'd like also to thank Ms. Priscilla Robinson, who has assisted me in my work as a member of the symposium's advisory committee. Now I have to, in the Jamaican language, big up Ms. Natalie Reed, who made the administrative and other arrangements for the symposium. How she was able to do that in combination with her law practice, I will never be able to understand. We are also indebted to Professor Chantal Thomas, who introduced the discussion yesterday. And finally, my thanks to Professor Gregory Schaffer, who is the president of the American Society of International Law, for his introductory remarks. Ladies and gentlemen, the Brattle Group have quantified the reparations due for TCS at over $101 trillion. This figure comprises approximately $78 trillion as reparations for the harm caused during enslavement and approximately $22 trillion for the harm caused in the period after enslavement. These figures are what former slaveholding countries are required to pay by way of compensation to the descendants of the enslaved. In respect of the period during enslavement, Table 29 sets out the sum that each country in which enslavement was carried out is entitled to receive as compensation. It also identifies the former slaveholding country to pay that compensation. Table 18 sets out the compensation in the post-enslavement period that each country in which TCS was carried out is entitled to receive. At the same time, it identifies the former slaveholding country that is to pay that reparation. And I just mentioned, I am not insensitive to what George Yusuf said about who is to receive the compensation, what groups of people will have to attend to that. Ladies and gentlemen, this symposium is historic in that it has, through the Grapher Report, comprehensively set out the sums to be paid by all former slaveholding countries to all the descendants of the enslaved. In that regard, please recall that in my opening remarks, I said that we, descendants of the enslaved, wherever we are today, we all came to these parts on the same boat. Of course, the symposium, as acknowledged in the report, has built on the work done by many others in the field, including Professor Hilary Beckles, Professor Vereen Shepherd, and Professor Robert Beckford. I wish to comment on one aspect of the report. It shows that reparations in the sum of about $78 trillion must be paid by a number of former slaveholding states to the descendants of the enslaved in several countries for wrongful conduct during the period of enslavement. Of that sum, to take an example, Jamaica is to receive $7.5 trillion, and the United Kingdom is required to pay as compensation to the countries in which it carried out TCS some $19 trillion. Now, by any measure, these are large sums. I'd like to make the following comments. Grapher's report is of a very high quality, evidencing much learning and scholarship from experienced economists and valuators. The methodology is carefully explained and it shows an admirable rigor in its analysis. Moreover, Brattle has been conservative in its conclusion. In its work, Brattle had to make assumptions about the number of people born into slavery outside the United States. For every enslaved person embarked to the United States, 22 persons were born into slavery. However, this ratio was likely lower in other countries. For example, the calculation used in the documentary, The Empire Pays Back, assumes one person born to slavery for every three that were embarked. As a conservative assumption, the Brattle Group followed this 1-to-3 ratio in their calculations. Moreover, although there was more than ample evidence to support an interest rate of 3%, Brattle used the lower rate of 2.5%. Why then are the figures so high? Ladies and gentlemen, the figures are high because the period for the calculation of compensation at a particular rate of interest runs for hundreds of years from the date of enslavement to the present day. The report makes the point that the payment of interest preserves the time value of money, and that one of the purposes of an interest rate is to offset inflation. It is interesting to note that the International Law Commission's articles on state responsibility explicitly address the question whether the principle of full reparation may lead to disproportionate and even crippling requirements so far as the responsible state is concerned. The commentary on Article 34 refers to the principle of proportionality as an aspect of the obligation to make full reparations. Thus, Article 35 precludes restitution if it would involve a burden out of all proportion to the benefit gained by the other injured party. Similarly, Article 36 states that satisfaction should not be out of proportion to the injury. While there is no such provision in relation to compensation, it has to be noted that under Article 36, the obligation is to compensate for damage that has actually occurred as a result of the wrongful conduct. The question whether compensation may be too burdensome for the responsible state was recently addressed by the International Court of Justice. In its 2022 judgment, in the armed activities on the territory of the Congo, Democratic Republic of the Congo versus Uganda, a war that lasted 5 years between the two countries, the ICJ considered the question whether in determining the amount of compensation, account should be taken of the financial burden imposed on the responsible state, given its economic condition, in particular, if there is any doubt about the state's capacity to pay without compromising its ability to meet its people's basic needs. And after considering the total amount of compensation awarded to the Democratic Republic of Congo, as well as the terms of the payment of the compensation, the court concluded that it was, here I quote, satisfied that the total sum awarded and the terms of payment remain within the capacity of Uganda to pay, end of quote. Ladies and gentlemen, I would not conclude without addressing the important issue raised by Dr. Mamadou Hebi yesterday. Dr. Hebi observed that in determining the number of persons born into enslavement, the Bratton Group had two options. It chose the lower option, following the approach taken in the documentary, The Empire Pays Back. That documentary, as already mentioned, worked on the assumption that for every three embarkations to the Caribbean, one person was born into slavery, as distinct from the situation in the USA, where 22 persons were born into slavery for every one enslaved person embarked to the United States. It appeared to Dr. Hebi that this approach was taken by Bratton because it was safer and more conservative. But Dr. Hebi, good international lawyer that he is, questions whether a determination should not have been made as a matter of law as to the number of persons born into enslavement. He has raised an important issue relating to the allocation of decision-making responsibilities concerning the work of the symposium. When I started examining the legal framework for reparations for transatlantic chattel slavery, I immediately realized that reparations could not be determined by experts without some other body having a role in that determination. There had to be a body that would receive the reports of the experts and ultimately come to a conclusion on the reparations that are due. And that was why I established an advisory committee. But admittedly, I was very conflicted as to the role of this committee. At times I felt that it was for the committee and not for the experts to determine reparations on the basis of the principle of equitable considerations. In the result, the matter was never settled, but we do have an advisory committee, and one of its functions is to resolve difficult issues. In relation to the particular matter raised by Dr. Hebe, I should say that the determination of the number of persons born into enslavement should be made as a matter of law on the basis of the principle of equitable considerations, which I explained yesterday. Essentially, it allows for a reasonable estimation. In conclusion then, Brackel's law assumption is consistent with the principle of equitable considerations. But Dr. Hebe raised another matter. He raised the issue of reparations for Africa resulting from transatlantic chattel slavery. I had included population displacement as a head of damage in one of the earlier iterations of heads of damages. I believe it was felt that we should concentrate on reparations for the descendants of those who were enslaved in the Americas and the Caribbean. However, there can be no doubt that the population displacement experienced by African countries significantly affected their growth and development. And after hearing from Dr. Hebe and Judge Yusuf on this matter, I want to say that this is a matter that deserves the attention of the advisory committee, and we will look into it. May I just briefly comment on what Judge Yusuf had to say about Article 30 and the obligation to cease a wrongful act if it is continuing? He is absolutely right. And I thank him for reminding us. We tend to take things for granted sometimes, you know? But it is very important that in our work, we should tell the former slaveholding countries that they must cease the wrongful act, the discrimination that continues, you know. And he's also absolutely right about focusing on the descendants of the enslaved. Doesn't mean that you forget our ancestors. But what we face today is a set of people who are disadvantaged and generally impoverished on account of transatlantic chattel slavery. Also, he was absolutely correct about stress on the Netherlands and other countries providing an account of the violations in educational materials at all levels as a form of satisfaction. And Professor Shepherd has addressed that. And I'd also like to thank Dr. Mustafa Kazazi for what he has just told us. In particular, Dr. Kazazi, being a practitioner in the field, he has brought his experience to bear.